ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making its One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
This week on The Science Show, we head down a mine in search for dark matter.
And find out how eugenics shaped birth control in Australia.
We celebrate the Adelaide-born so-called Mozart of maths.
And we ask, where are all our memories stored? And what happens when that storage is corrupted? I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams. And big biosecurity news from the past week. H5 bird flu has been confirmed in Australia for the first time.
That's right. And next week we'll bring you a story about how scientists have been preparing for exactly this to keep our native animals safe.
Meanwhile, Australian birds have been helping researchers overseas. Professor of Biology Carlos Loess at Caltech works with zebra finches to understand how our brains work and where memories are stored.
We're sitting in your lab here at Caltech, and you're showing me a picture of two little Australians, zebra finches. Why these birds?
The main reason that we like to work with zebra finches is that, in contrast to many other laboratory animals, they have a very, very useful feature for us. They have a behavior that can be quantified very, very precisely. And it's their song. So these animals learn a song from their parents, and after that, they only sing that song for the rest of their lives, 10 years or 12 years. And they sing hundreds and hundreds of songs every day. This is something that, for instance, in mice is not possible. Mice don't have any intrinsic spontaneous behavior.
So each different zebra finch family has a different song.
Correct. You could say that they have some different dialects. Yeah. So then we can quantify very, very well because they sing hundreds of songs every day. And then we can do very, very good statistics. And because of that, we can do very good correlation of what happens in their brains and the behavior that they produce.
Could you play some for me?
Sure. So what you are going to hear now is going to be not just one song, it's going to be the same song repeated many, many times because they sing the same song over and over and over. Here it goes. The animal was repeating each song, individual song is actually very short, it's 1 second approximately, but they sing the same thing over and over and over in what is called bouts. Sometimes those bouts can be 20 or 30 repetitions of the same song. And because of that, we can analyze the song very precisely using very powerful statistics. Simply, we just put a microphone in the cage where the animals are, we just let them go to their business, and then they just produce hundreds of songs every day, and then we can analyze them. In addition to that, we know not only the behavior that they produce, but we know the parts of the brain that are important for the animals to produce those songs. So we know where are the key neurons that are necessary for the production of the song. In the song, you could hear that there is something that you could call syllables. Basically, the song is not continuous. It has some individual acoustic elements that we call syllables. A normal song of a zebra finch might have between 4 to 6 syllables. The main reason that we like to work with zebra finches is that once they have learned the song from their fathers, only the male sings, not the females, once they have learned the song from the fathers at approximately 90 days after hatching, they keep the same song for many years virtually unchanged. So this would be the equivalent in humans of asking somebody when they are 10 years old, what is their name, and then recording that sound, and then asking the same question when they are 30 years old, 60 years old, or 19 years old, and they will say their name in almost indistinguishable acoustic features.
Now, may I just say that budgerigars do this as well, as I found out when they started talking language to me, but they've got more variety. And the mechanism is the same. To keep the families together of 3 or 4 when they're flying in flocks sometimes of hundreds You know, here is my registered noise or song or speech to keep us together.
That is one of the functions of the song for, as I mentioned before, only the male sing, not the female. So one of the reasons that these animals sing is because that is a way of attracting females so that the females are willing to mate with them. And actually, we know for many other experiments over the years that the females select for males that have complex songs, meaning with several syllables, that acoustically it's pleasing to them. And another thing that is very important, that even when the animals are repeating the same song one after another, there is a lot of reliability, meaning the females somehow, they really value the fact that the males are able to produce the song almost identical many, many times in a row, perhaps in a way of saying, maybe not the best analogy, what you don't want is an animal that produces different songs every time, because probably it will mean that their brains are not that stable. So reliability is something that the females find very, very attractive. Okay, so then a normal animal can keep the same song virtually identical for many years. So this is a very good baseline, because what we are interested is that what are the mechanisms in the brain that enable animals to keep these songs for so many years. So we can do different types of genetic manipulations, because we know the neurons that are important for the singing, and then we can manipulate the activity of those neurons, and then we see how that affects the behavior, in this case, the song that they produce. So, for instance, some of the type of experiments that we can do is that using genetic methods, we can selectively inactivate the neurons that are important for the singing, let's say in this case, in an irreversible way. So we have the part of the brain that is important for the singing, we generate some genetic delivery vehicles, and we selectively and permanently inactivate some of those neurons. Okay, so what is the outcome of this? What we see is that before we do anything, we have a normal song. After just a few days later, after we do this genetic manipulation, not much has happened. But by 8 days, the song has fallen apart to the degree that is unrecognizable. By 10 days, it still is completely disorganized. But by 12 days, the song comes back completely normal. And maybe you can hear now the differences. Okay, so this is the normal song. Now, this is the song 7 or 8 days, and you will hear that it's very different. A couple of days later, the song is still very broken. But by 12 days, the song has come back basically indistinguishable from the original one. So this is the song 12 days after the manipulation. So this is 12 days, and just for comparison, this was before the manipulation. So in just an interval of approximately 2 weeks, by doing this very severe manipulation of neural activity, we have gone from a normal song to a completely degraded song, but just after 2 weeks, the song is able to come back in a completely normal way. So obviously what this is telling us is that there is something in the brain of these animals that is able to hold the memory of the song. And even if we perturb the activity of the neurons in a very drastic way, the song is able to come back. So going back with the analogy of the orchestra, so imagine that you have an orchestra with 100 musicians, and for whatever reason, let's say 50% of them get sick. Maybe the initial performances will be disastrous, but after 2 weeks, somehow they are able to produce music that sounds perfectly well, even though 50% of the musicians are not in the orchestra anymore. So obviously we are very interested in this at two levels. One, to understand what are the basic cellular mechanisms by which the brain is able to maintain the information. But the second part is that if we know something about these mechanisms, this could be very useful, for instance, to allow people, let's say, after a stroke or even after Alzheimer's disease, to preserve some of their memory.
You said people. Uh-huh. We have brains which are so much bigger and so much more complex, and yet my brain has had memories which go back many decades. Mm-hmm. And are you suggesting that there is a repair mechanism that goes back to a normal, I've got consistent?
Correct. It's not even a question of repair mechanism. There is something that we don't give our brains credit for it. Our brains are updating the information continuously. Let's say, imagine that you have a car. If you don't bring your car to the mechanic so that every now and then they change the oil of the engine and, you know, whatever they have to do with the car will fall apart. We do updates with the cars, and that's the reason that we can keep cars running for a long time. Our brain is constantly updating its information, otherwise it will drift and the memories will disappear.
The memories. Now, what are the memories made of? Because, okay, they're circuits, and people use the example of a computer, which is not necessarily satisfactory.
I think that is a terrible analogy, and we can talk about it later.
And then there are the ideas of proteins, some of them in the cell, which may also be the memory. So if you think the computer is a bad example, what is the memory made of?
The textbook take-home message that is commonly accepted is that memories are stored in the connections between neurons that are called synapses. To me, that is a just-so story, meaning it's a nice bedtime story that makes perhaps a bit of sense, but to me, the thing that doesn't make sense is that I can imagine that you can hold some kind of information in those synapses for a few hours or for a few days. I cannot see how you can have memories stored in synapses over 60 years. Over 60 years, synapses, they turn over, they disappear, new ones appear. There will be a lot of drift of information. If information was stored in synapses, I think that our brains will not be able to hold information for more than a few days. So I have the feeling that there is something very, very fundamental about how the brain stores information that we still don't know.
I was hoping you would say we have found out what it is, but you're saying we still don't know.
We don't know. We don't know at all. And to me, one of the worst things is that in particular for the students, medical students, graduate students, in the textbooks, we do tell them that we do know how memories are stored in the brain, and we tell them the official party line, which is that those memories are stored in synapses. I think that the evidence for that is very, very marginal. Maybe that information could be stored in synapses for a few hours or days, not for decades.
But surely the synapses are just joins between the neurons in circuits, and the memories might be in the circuits in the brain.
So let me see. I'm giving perhaps too many analogies, but the idea would be, so for instance, imagine that you have a computer and then you are looking at whatever you are doing in the computer in the screen. If you don't know anything about how computers work, somebody might think, oh, the information in the computer is stored in the screen because if I don't turn off the computer, the information is always is the same information in the screen. But we do know that the information is actually of the computer is not in the screen. The information of the computer is stored in another part of the computer. The screen is just the most visible part of the computer. That's not where the information is. I think that synapses are absolutely necessary to transmit information between neurons. And without synapses, the brain doesn't work. There is no doubt about that synapses are fundamental for the transmission of information.
Let me give you a thought experiment, one that you know of, and that is with some of us, like yourself, like me, my second language was German. And if I would have a stroke, I would lose not necessarily most of my language, English and Austrian, German in other words, but how would the removal of language go according to experiments and experience?
So according to the experience, and this is something that neurologists, they see in clinical practice all the time, is that for people that are raised in one language, let's say in my case, Spanish, and then as adults, they learn a second language, in my case, English, if in the future I have a stroke or any other neurological disease and I cannot speak for a while, the first language that will come up will be Spanish, and then a few weeks or months later, it will be English. Even though I have been speaking English for 34 years on a daily basis, I don't speak Spanish that much. But the memory of Spanish in my brain is much more stable than the memory of English in my brain.
Even though you don't use it, and even though it must surely be repaired when there's some sort of accident with your Spanish without knowing it.
It's not exactly repair, it's updated. And this is something that we are very interested in studying. Our brains are constantly making what people call predictive models, meaning, let's say that you want to drink, and then you see that there is a glass of water in front of you, so then you make a model of what do you have to do how to move your arm and your shoulder and your hand to grab a cup of water. Now, in most cases, our brains respond very well to the commands that we give them so that our muscles grab the cup of water. But sometimes we realize that this actually does not work that well. So then the brain detects that there is an error between the model, the prediction, and the actuality of grabbing the cup of water. So now, whenever the brain detects any kind of error, so then it's doing some fine-tuning to be able to correct that error so that we don't keep doing that error anymore. So those kind of updates to minimize the errors of the performance of our brain, they're happening all the time, not only for motor control, but even for memories. If somebody asks you, I don't know, what is the capital of Australia? And then somebody says, Sydney, then you say, no, actually, it's not Sydney. I think it's Canberra, correct? Yeah. So then if somebody makes the mistake and they are corrected, then it's really important that you do not perpetuate your mistake of thinking that the capital of Australia is Sydney. So our brain is doing continuous correction of errors for anything that you can imagine. Memories, feelings, motion control, etc.
Carlos Lois, professor of biology at Caltech, exploring the intricacies of the brain. To think, Bill, one of the most mysterious objects in the universe is between your ears. More next week.
And of course, one of the greatest brains on the planet sits in the skull of mathematician Terence Tao.
Yes, winner of the Fields Medal, but more recently winner of the highest Australian award, the AC. Professor Tao has always avoided publicity, saying he'd rather use the time to help his students. He's at UCLA, the University of California, Los Angeles, and I spoke to him there a while ago.
When you were growing up in Adelaide, what turned you on to maths so young, at the age of 2, when most of us are just still learning to talk?
Well, as long as I can remember, I liked numbers and logic puzzles and anything with a definite objective answer. But one of my earliest memories was seeing my grandmother washing windows. I think I was 3 or something. And I demanded that she put the detergent on the windows in the shape of numbers. So I always liked numbers. When I was 7 or 8, whenever I was getting too rowdy at night, my parents would give me a maths workbook to work on to quiet me down.
One thing that put me off and other people like me is that it seemed that maths had always a right answer or an infinity of wrong answers. But many people we've broadcast recently who are mathematicians, not least a science teacher who helped get one of the Australia Day prizes, was that maths is creative, that it's not simply an iron road, but it's flexible and imaginative as well.
Right. So there's often one right answer, but what is often not taught in classes is that there's many ways to get that answer. And kids often have natural intuition and creativity about numbers. I have a daughter who's 6, and she has homework where she has to add 2 numbers, and she does it in creative ways. You know, like if she has to add 16 to something, she adds 20 and takes off 4 and does a bit roundabout, but it's sort of her own creative way. Now, unfortunately, what happens sometimes is that math teachers, maybe they're not so well trained in mathematics, they've only learned to teach one particular way to do something. And if a student is being creative and found a different way to do a problem, which isn't the way that's in the textbook, they may get points docked off or get told off, and the student get discouraged. Yeah, so you have to play with it. You have to tinker with it in order to really make it your own. And fortunately, in the classroom environment, sometimes that doesn't happen.
And so you felt that kind of liberty when you were growing up with maths?
Yeah, so I played with maths a lot outside of the school environment. I devoured maths books. During the weekends, there was a retired maths professor who I had tea and scones with, and he would tell me about how he used maths in the war, and he had a little maths journal where he would do these recreational maths puzzles. There was all these fancy combinatorial counting problems that he would recast in terms of stories about the Knights of the Round Table. I was always playing with mathematics. A bit later on, I participated in maths competitions where I went abroad and represented my country for a few of these.
And you got the first gold, I remember.
Well, I think I was the youngest to win it at the time. Maybe I still am, actually.
Still the youngest?
By about 6 months or something. There was a Peruvian boy who also got it recently.
Interesting. Now, I haven't looked at your work in great depth, but it seems to me you're looking mainly at numbers, at pure maths. Do you ever go trying to solve physics problems using what you know?
Not directly. So I have studied equations that were motivated by physics, but I studied the pure aspects of them. I did do one work which had practical impact because I collaborated with a statistician and engineer who were interested in trying to speed up certain measurement acquisition techniques, like in magnetic resonance imaging, and to try to get a good MRI scan using fewer measurements. And they managed to convert it into a pure maths problem, which I could then work with, and we managed to solve the problem. And so we now have developed this technique called compressed sensing, where we were one of the people to develop it. And MRI scans now, in some cases, we can speed them up by a factor of up to 10. A scan that would take 3 minutes may take 30 seconds.
I was just wondering, sometimes in a particular field, I've just done an interview with one of your colleagues who's a physicist, actually working in chemistry. You look at a particular thing and it illuminates what might be the answer outside your field. And I just thought that as you explore what numbers can do and the way pure mathematics can lift curtains, you can think, hey, that might help in this particular aspect.
Right, yeah. So this is the great role that mathematics plays in the sciences, that it's so abstract that there are ideas which may originate in one discipline, but mathematics can abstract the key features of it, which can then be used in other disciplines. So, for example, this technique that we use to speed up MRI scans actually originated in seismology. People wanted to detect faults in the ground using very limited measurements, and they had developed a technique to do that empirically, but they had no mathematical explanation of why it worked and what else it was good for. But we managed to analyze it mathematically, and we saw that it wasn't just restricted to seismology. You could actually use it for many things. So it's now used in MRI scans and astronomy and all kinds of other domains.
Anything on the horizon now that you're working on like that?
Nothing practical like that. Yeah, so right now I'm working entirely on pure projects. I still work with numbers. I try to find patterns in the primes. Prime numbers, that's what I'm, I guess, most known for. I also work on the equations of fluid motion. There's an old mathematical problem. Can you make water blow up? Is there any configuration of a fluid like water, which if you run the equations of fluids, it creates a catastrophe. The fluid velocity becomes infinite. You make an explosion. We don't believe that's possible, but I'm trying to cook up a really special configuration of fluids that does that. All theoretical. I'm not going to actually blow up anything.
Has an effort been made in the United States to get young people? I don't mean teenagers. I mean primary school. I mean as young as you were when you started, age 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, there's no really big national effort that I'm aware of. I mean, there's lots of grassroots activities. You know, for example, one thing that's very popular right now are math circles. You know, so groups of kids anywhere from kindergarten to high school. They meet on the weekends. There are these volunteer, like graduate students, for example, presenting them some area of modern mathematics, but in a very accessible way and outside of the classroom environment where they get to experiment and play. And these are very popular. There's one here at UCLA, and it's like 10 times as many kids trying to get in as that we have slots. And once a kid is interested in mathematics, the internet is an amazing resource these days. There's so many excellent high-quality educational materials, YouTube videos. There's some excellent math YouTube bloggers right now. And even Wikipedia. The accuracy of Wikipedia can be dodgy in some places, but in math, it's really quite good. But the bottleneck, really, is getting the kids interested in math in the first place. And I think it's really having the right math teacher is crucial.
Yes, you had a woman in your story, didn't you, in school?
Oh, yeah. She was amazing. She took time to personally, you know, so I hang out in her office quite often. She would teach me Latin, which because I was curious about it and she knew it. Yeah, actually, the principal in my high school and my primary school were always very accommodating. I had a very unusual schedule. They designed sort of a tailor-made curriculum for me, which was great.
Winner of the AC, the highest ranked order of Australia, just a couple of weeks ago on the long weekend, Terence Tao is at UCLA.
And this is the Sideshow on ABC Radio National.
We mentioned Snowlab in Canada a couple of weeks ago, where our guide was Dan Falk from CBC, a science journalist specialising in physics. So why should this lab be 2 kilometres down and utterly, utterly clean?
If you drive north from Toronto for a couple of hours and then keep on driving, you eventually get to the small city of Sudbury, Ontario. Now, every city has its attractions. Sydney has the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge. London has the Houses of Parliament. And Sudbury, well, Sudbury has the Big Nickel.
Oh, up there, I see it. All right, Nickel. Now I'm happy.
That other voice is American science writer George Musser. We drove up here together.
I thought it was going to be 5 or 6 meters across. I think it's almost 10 meters across.
It is way bigger than we thought. This is enormous.
The Big Nickel is the world's largest coin, a gigantic 5-cent piece. In Canada and the US, they're called nickels. Now, a giant coin may seem pretty random, but there's actually a logical, historical reason why it's here. The Big Nickel honors the nickel coin, but it also celebrates the element nickel, number 28 on the periodic table, the metal that most Canadian coins used to be made from. There's a lot of nickel beneath the ground here in Sudbury, and they've been mining it for more than 120 years. But the Creighton mine, located just outside the city, is special, because along with the actual mining operation, there's also a unique scientific laboratory, located inside the mine, deep below ground. Having rested up after our big nickel adventure, we're up early the next morning to make our way to the Creighton mine. It's about 5 a.m. and still pitch dark out, so we're a little bit lost. We're on the lookout for our guide, Juliette Deloy.
Yes, there she is.
When I visited here the first time, back in the late 1990s, the laboratory was called the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, or SNOW. In the early 2000s, the lab expanded and was rebranded as SNOW Lab. Juliette Deloy is SNOW Lab's Education and Outreach Coordinator.
We're looking at the Creighton Mine Shaft Number 9 mining site. This is essentially where the cables for the elevator that will take us underground travel through.
Remind me how long the mine has been here.
Creighton Mine's been around for just around 100 years now. There's a couple different components to Creighton Mine. There's an open pit mine that isn't really in use anymore, but there's also the underground mine where we are today.
Taking advantage of the mine shaft and underground tunnels that had already been here for decades, scientists set their sights on the mine in the 1990s and built the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. Neutrinos are elusive subatomic particles that have almost no mass and hardly interact with other types of matter. Work on neutrinos carried out at SNOW would eventually garner a Nobel Prize.
I'm Ray Bunker. I'm the director of research at SNOW Lab.
Physicist Ray Bunker is originally from the States. He joined the team at SNOW Lab about a year and a half ago. At SNOW Lab, Bunker and his colleagues are probing the mysteries of the cosmos, from the Big Bang to the nature of dark matter. And as weird as it may seem, even though they're studying the universe, the best place to do it is from deep below ground.
What is particularly unique about SNOW Lab is its combination of depth and cleanliness. It is the deepest, cleanest laboratory in the world for conducting underground science of the various types that we pursue.
Now, getting down into the mine is a whole big production. SNOW Lab is located some 2 kilometers below ground, and this is a working mine. So the first order of business is to change out of our street clothes and into industrial mining gear. Coveralls, a hard hat, ear protectors, the whole bit. Well, there's only one way down. We ride down in a 5-foot by 12-foot elevator that they call the cage. You could almost squeeze a Volkswagen Beetle into it, if the cage wasn't already full of mine workers.
It's a little bit noisy, eh?
It sure is.
Eventually, we get to the level of the laboratory.
So we are now 6,800 feet underground in Creighton Mine.
We're 6,800 feet, or 2 kilometers, beneath the surface. To put that in perspective, we're 5 times further below ground than the tip of the Empire State Building is above ground. And the air pressure is about 25% greater than at the surface. And now we start walking, because it's a 1.5 kilometer trek through the mine tunnels, called the Drift, before we reach the laboratory. Eventually, we get to SNOW Lab itself. And then we're inside. Instead of the exposed rock that you see in the Drift, the walls of the lab are coated with a type of spray on concrete, which is then painted with a special low radioactivity paint. The lab isn't just clean, it's also got just about the lowest levels of radioactivity anywhere in the world. Down here, there are 2 main sources of radiation that scientists have to worry about. As Ray Bunker explains, the first issue is the particles that bombard the Earth from deep space and from our own atmosphere.
The main challenge, the main reason for going underground is to shield our experiments from cosmic ray muons, which are created in the upper atmosphere by primarily protons that come from outer space and hit the atmosphere. Muons are very penetrating. The only effective shield from them is to go deep underground and use this 2 kilometers of Earth as shielding against the cosmic ray muons.
So having all of this rock above our heads helps to minimize the number of pesky muons that get through. But the rocks themselves are also slightly radioactive, which means the dirt that we trampled through as we walked through the drift is also a little bit radioactive. And that's why we have to change clothes once again. The mining gear comes off, and everyone has to take a shower so that we don't bring bits of radioactive dirt with us as we enter the lab. They're especially adamant that everyone washes their hair. Apparently, your hair can be a real hornet's nest of radioactive dirt. You might remember going to the doctor or the dentist and getting an x-ray, and being given a lead apron to protect whatever part of you wasn't being x-rayed. Well, here it's the other way around. You're the object that's emitting too much radiation, and the concern is that you will contaminate the lab. Now that we've scrubbed ourselves down and put on clean lab clothes, we can tour the laboratory, greatly expanded since my previous visit almost 30 years ago. Try to picture a rabbit warren scaled up to the size of a small village. There are cavern-like chambers filled with lab equipment of every description, control rooms with banks of computer terminals, and dozens of scientists going about their work. Our first stop is an experiment designed to snare particles of dark matter.
So now we're in the corner of the Ladder Labs where the Super CDMS dark matter experiment is located. That's the Super Cryogenic Dark Matter Search.
Bunker is showing us an experiment called Super CDMS, designed to detect particles of dark matter. Not that you could tell what it's for from its appearance. At the time of my visit, they were still working on the outer layers of shielding for the experiment, so it basically looked like an enormous metal cylinder, several meters high and just as wide, and partially hidden behind some pipes and scaffolding. Deep inside the metal cylinder are the germanium and silicon crystals that act as a target for dark matter particles. And those crystals have to be kept cold, and I mean really cold, to minimize so-called thermal noise. And that explains the loud, pulsating sound that fills the entire chamber. The noise is coming from machines called pulse tube coolers, which push high-pressure liquid helium through pipes, something like the piston in your car's engine if your car was as cold as outer space. Here's Ray Bunker again.
The reason it has to be kept so cold is the approach for detecting dark matter here is to use large kilogram scale germanium and silicon crystals. Dark matter, we hope, comes along, interacts with an atom in the crystal, vibrates it, and in order to detect the small amount of vibration, you have to reject all the other vibration. And you do that by making them very cold. And so then you have a chance of seeing this very rare interaction of a dark matter particle pinging an atom in your crystal.
And we'll return to Snow Lab in a few weeks to see whether anything at all has been discovered and why scientists still keep going to all that trouble.
And also here in Australia, we'll have a dark matter detector of our own, but in a gold mine rather than a nickel mine. Last I heard, those instruments will be installed a little later this year. Also this year is the centenary of Family Planning Australia. But Robin, did you know that the birth control movement was not just a feminist movement, but also a eugenic one?
I didn't.
It's true. And, you know, eugenics is the now discredited belief that the human population could be improved by selectively breeding what were considered the best people. A leading figure in the eugenics movement was Marie Stopes. She was born in Edinburgh in the 1880s, and at the turn of the century,
Stopes actually became a scientist.
This is Jane Carey, a historian at the University of Wollongong.
She becomes the youngest Doctor of Science in Britain. She studies paleobotany. Her specialty is actually coal. I think that the classification system that she developed in her PhD work for coal is actually still being used.
So Stopes had a very prestigious scientific career, but then she turned her attention to birth control.
The story goes the reason that she did this was because she married, but the marriage was never consummated because both parties were so sexually ignorant they did not know that they were not actually having sex properly.
What were they doing?
I don't know.
Wow.
I'm sorry, I don't have that juicy detail.
That's fine.
Oh my goodness. So the marriage gets annulled. But this is a precipitating moment for Stopes. And then during World War One, when she becomes very interested in this idea of birth control and also of women's sexual pleasure. This is probably the direct product from her own failed marital experience. And she writes this book that becomes a worldwide bestseller called Married Love. And this has lots of tips and advice about how to have a good time as a married couple. And it also has information about birth control, because for Stopes, for women to enjoy sex, they have to be free from the fear of getting pregnant constantly.
Mm.
But she's already a eugenicist, so these ideas merge.
Meanwhile, over in the US, a nurse called Margaret Sanger was treating mothers who'd had incredibly dangerous back alley abortions to avoid having more kids. So Sanger thought, well, why not birth control? Problem was, birth control and literature about birth control were considered obscene in the United States. And if you were caught distributing either, you could be punished with a fine, jail, or both. Margaret Sanger took that risk.
She became a socialist feminist, and she published this now very famous pamphlet called On Family Limitation, which was all about birth control, and this is what got her arrested. So to avoid prosecution, she goes to England, where she meets Marie Stopes and a whole bunch of other people who are involved in the eugenics movement. And Stopes organises a campaign to lobby the president, Woodrow Wilson, to withdraw the charges against Sanger. And so she writes a letter, gets all the other key eugenicists to sign it, including H.G. Wells.
That's H.G. Wells of War of the Worlds fame. Anyway, the letter campaign worked because Margaret Sanger went back to the US, her charges were dismissed, and in 1918, the law banning contraception was loosened. Women could now use birth control, like diaphragms and sponges with spermicide, as long as they were prescribed by a doctor. So Sanger founded a birth control organisation and in 1923 opened the first legal birth control clinic in the US.
But she very much courts the support of eugenicists in America as part of this campaign. And some of the people that she interacts with are avowed white supremacists. People like Madison Grant, who writes a book called The Passing of the Great Race or The Racial Basis of European History, which appeared in 1916, and Lopthorpe Stoddard's 1921 publication, The Rising Tide of Colour Against White World Supremacy.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty clear cut.
This is unambiguous, and these were the kinds of people that Sanger was interacting with. And these were leading figures of the eugenics movement in the US that Sanger was more broadly trying to garner support for, and at one point tries to organise a merger between a birth control organisation and the American Eugenics Society.
Meanwhile, Marie Stopes, still an avowed eugenicist, she'd opened the UK's first birth control clinic in 1921.
So there's huge intersections between the birth control movements that Stopes and Sanger are leading and eugenics movements in both the UK and US at this time.
Also around this time, it wasn't just Northern Hemisphere elites who were really into eugenics.
Eugenics was incredibly and quite shockingly mainstream and respectable.
This is Eve Rees, a historian at La Trobe University.
Virtually all the progressive intellectuals, thinkers, feminists, politicians of the day, you know, adhered to what we'd now call some form of eugenic thought.
Including in Australia, where the Immigration Restriction Act of 1901, also known as the White Australia Policy, was designed to limit non-British migration. In 1926, the organisation that would one day become Family Planning Australia was born. It was first known as the Race Improvement Society and later the Racial Hygiene Association, and its aims were to educate the public about venereal diseases and, you guessed it, eugenics.
The organisation used the phrase racial hygiene, and what they sort of generally meant by that was racial fitness in terms of promoting, the health and well-being of the human race. This, of course, was in the wake of World War I, when a lot of soldiers had caught venereal disease and the apparent threat it posed to population health were very live concerns. And also this concept of the feeble-minded or the disabled, as we might say today, posing a threat to the population was another big concern in terms of racial fitness. So the Racial Hygiene Association advocated for the sterilisation and also the segregation of the people they called the feeble-minded. But I guess it's sort of important to keep in mind as well that this all occurred in the bigger context of the White Australia policy and the ideal population that promoters of racial hygiene were wanting to kind of foster in Australia was implicitly a white population as well.
The founding president of the Racial Hygiene Association, Ruby Rich, wasn't a scientist like Stopes or a nurse like Sanger. She was a pianist, among other things. But like Stopes and Sanger, Ruby Rich was a feminist and a eugenicist.
And even though today in 2026 we might see those two ideas as being antithetical, at the time in the 1920s for Rich and many of her contemporaries in the feminist movement and in progressive causes more generally, those two ideas went very much hand in hand. For Rich in particular, she saw racial hygiene as a way to ensure that all babies born were healthy and wanted through promoting sex education and through the early provision of contraception in New South Wales.
That said, Rich and the organisation did associate with eugenicists of the white supremacy variety. For instance, at a fundraiser for the organisation in 1927, a judge made a speech that included this line: "Are we going to have a white Australia? Not merely white in skin, but white at heart. A really good, clean Australia?" Yeah. Anyway, the Racial Hygiene Association opened its first birth control clinic in 1933. So how much of this work was a commitment to women's issues versus curbing the reproduction of people they considered to be unfit to reproduce?
I mean, that is the ultimate question around this history and around this issue, that I think both interpretations are valid and coexisted. For Rich and other women involved in this movement, certainly their stated concern was that they were driven by feminist concerns for the reproductive rights and freedoms of working class women. And you can see that it's a valid argument that some women who were operating on very small budgets and may have already had many children, that it could have been very liberating to have had the freedom to not have any more children if they didn't want that. Mm. So that is a credible argument. But also we know that on a broader level, the general discourse around ideas of who is fit and who was fit and unfit to reproduce and who was more likely to be feeble-minded and so on, the general consensus that these qualities were most concentrated in working class populations. The clinic initially opened in Martin Place in Sydney CBD, but it soon moved to Chippendale, which was then a very working class area, so they could target those working class populations. That was not at all concealed.
Around this time, the Racial Hygiene Association introduced a marriage advisory centre, which offered premarital counselling to see if two people who were thinking of getting married were fit to reproduce.
They were given extensive surveys about their medical history, about their mental health, about their general character. And some of the psychiatric questions are quite funny in a way, because they asked couples about, do you have a morbid fear of bridges or things like that? And I've always wondered, you know, like, what is having a morbid fear of bridges meant to say about you as a person and, you know, whether you were fit to reproduce or not? But we know that Ruby Rich studied psychoanalysis in Switzerland after World War One, and there's even some speculation that she studied with Freud himself. So she was certainly very influenced by psychoanalytic thinking. Again, there's no explicit language that is centering whiteness and promoting white supremacy, but I think we can assume that in practice there would be, according to the logic of that centre, very strongly discouraged a white settler marrying an Indigenous person or a settler of colour, for instance.
But then came World War II and the Holocaust. Eugenic policies were used to justify the involuntary sterilisation and mass murder of so-called undesirable populations. And while the explicit discourse of eugenics did mostly fall out of favour after World War II, it didn't disappear.
So the Racial Hygiene Association does rebrand as the Family Planning Association in 1960. But even as the Family Planning Association, its official documents and even its constitution continue to use the language of eugenics into the 80s. According to my research, it wasn't until 1989 that the word eugenics was removed from the constitution of the Family Planning Association, which is within certainly within my lifetime.
Absolutely.
And Rich herself, she continued to be a leader in this association. She served a second term as president in the 1960s. And she herself is vehemently touting the benefits of eugenics throughout the 60s, 70s and 80s, which is especially intriguing given that she was a very proud Jewish woman. She was actively involved in various Jewish organisations throughout her life, so would have been especially aware of the horrors of the Holocaust and the potential of eugenic thought to lead to a genocide. I guess I've come to think it's perhaps that this continued espousal of eugenics was made possible in the Australian context because it was relatively unsuccessful. The more extreme things that Rich and the Racial Hygiene Association were advocating, like sterilisation and segregation of the people they called the feeble-minded, were never implemented. They could continue with this, in retrospect, very naive assumption that this was just a way to promote human health and happiness.
How should advocates of the birth control movement today address the problematic aspects of the history and the organisations involved?
I think it's essential to be transparent about this history, but to do so in a sophisticated way that puts the eugenic origins of many of these birth control movements in their larger historical context and acknowledges that these were very mainstream ideas at the time. It doesn't mean these figures were entirely sinister or it shouldn't be used to discredit their other contributions and achievements. And of course, doesn't discredit at all the very valuable birth control work that they continue to do in the present.
Birth control's eugenics history is uncomfortable, no doubt, but not addressing it runs the very real risk it can be distorted and used to strip away reproductive rights even today. For instance, in 2022, arguments linking abortion to eugenics featured in debates surrounding the overturning of Roe v. Wade, eliminating the constitutional right to abortion in the US. The thing is, Margaret Sanger and Mari Stopes and Ruby Rich and those like them were all massively anti-abortion. 100 years ago, abortions were incredibly dangerous, and these women thought birth control could limit the number of abortions that needed to happen. Here's Jane Carey again.
There's been a lot of discussion of this history within reproductive rights organisations across the West over the last kind of 5-6 years, particularly starting in 2020 with the Black Lives Matter movement. So in response to that, several organisations have changed their names.
Such as Mari Stopes International, which began as the Mother's Clinic for Constructive Birth Control in London, founded by Stopes as the UK's first birth control clinic.
Sorry, Mari Stopes International changed its name to MSI. I mean, retaining the initials, you can argue how much of a name change is that. But these were accompanied by very strong statements distancing their organisations from the eugenic beliefs of Mari Stopes in particular in that case. And of course, in the US, there's been a complete disavowal of Margaret Sanger.
Perhaps most notably by the birth control organisation that she founded, which today is Planned Parenthood.
Her name was taken off the birth control clinic in New York. They had a prize named after her. They took her name off that. And there was an apology and an explicit distancing of the organisation from Margaret Sanger. The head of the organisation said, "We will no longer be apologising for Margaret Sanger." And that was something the organisation had been doing for years. So there's been a lot of attempts by contemporary reproductive health organisations and feminist organisations to try and come to terms with this history. I'm unsure the extent to which it's successful, in the sense that just changing the name of the organisation doesn't necessarily mean there's been structural change, that some of these ideas actually have persisted into the present in ways that are perhaps not obvious. And so I worry that those elements of these organisations will just continue. They can say, we're fine now, clearly not eugenicists. When there's a rising critique, particularly from women of colour, around a new concept, not of reproductive rights, but of reproductive justice. And that means the right to have children as well as the right to not have children.
What would it look like?
It would look very different. So in terms of the service provision, it would be something that included helping women who wanted to keep their children as well as women who wanted contraception or abortion. So that for a start. And to have those things not in the way that far-right campaigners say that, you know, women who want an abortion have to undergo counselling first just to try and make them change their mind. Not in that way. But in the way of having all of the options that women might need or want available in the same space.
Jane Carey from the University of Wollongong. I also spoke to Family Planning Australia CEO Sue Shilbury to find out how, in its 100th year, the organisation is acknowledging its history.
The link to eugenics is obviously an uncomfortable part of our history. Some of the language used in the past is certainly not consistent with the values of our organisation today. We can't change what's happened, but obviously we can own what's happened and be open about it. But yeah, it's really interesting because back in the 1920s, when Ruby Rich first established the organisation, they were more easily able to set up an organisation that was focused on family planning, contraception, as they called it, the eradication of venereal diseases, when it was under the auspices of the Racial Hygiene Society than actually calling it what it really was, which was family planning. So the title, in effect, was linked to that and linked to their ability to do what they wished to do without actually being considered inappropriate. But of course, with the fullness of time, that name has certain connotations about it that we're very conscious of, and particularly sorry for any harm or hurt it may have caused communities in the past or peoples that we've worked with. Because, yeah, it has, as we all know, connotations today that are uncomfortable. As we've looked back at our history with this in mind and had concerns about, well, how did that manifest itself in the early 20s and 30s, what we've identified is that the organisation very strongly condemned government policies of Aboriginal assimilation in the early 30s and the New South Wales Aboriginal Protection Policy, which endorsed separating Aboriginal children from their families, labelling these policies as extreme and unjustified. So that's been reassuring for us to unpack through exploring our history. We also know that from our early history that actually government authorities were monitoring the organisation during World War II. Because of the name and its potential connection to eugenics with a concern of Nazi leanings. And quite fascinating, the local police who knew about our activities responded to an inquiry about this and determined that the group had no record of racial targeting. And in fact, it had several Jewish people, which included Ruby Rich's members and leaders, so that it wasn't part of the organisation's focus. So I think unpacking our history has helped reassure us to some extent and enabled us to share with people the origins of it, things that we did not reflect what people might think eugenics is all about.
So eugenics back then was focused on curbing the reproduction of people that were considered unfit or feeble-minded, people that today we might consider to be disabled or have mental health issues. So while it may not have the white Australia race side of things, the early Racial Hygiene Association was more focused on the unfit or feeble-minded.
No, I think I want to be clear about that. I don't believe from what we've identified that was the case. I believe the original founders wanted to set up an organisation that could talk about family planning, contraception, STIs with the community, okay? And it wasn't possible at that time to call it out for what it was, family planning, for example. It was more socially appropriate at that time to talk about it under the eugenics, auspices of eugenics, which I know sounds bizarre 100 years later, but that was the case 100 years ago.
Sue Shilbury, CEO of Family Planning Australia. I'm Belinda Smith. Robin and I will be back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.